So the basic idea is that you encode a probability distribution in a graph, you know. The philosophy for machine learning is the idea that you have, it's the same as what you guys have been dealing with already, is you have data that's sampled according to a probability distribution. And what you're trying to do is build a model of that probability distribution, okay? So if you have a whole bunch of pictures of cats, and you're feeding those into a neural network, in this case, what that neural network will be once it's trained is a model of the probability distribution underlying all those cat pictures. So it doesn't make much sense for cats, but it makes a lot of sense for physics type models, okay? So we're gonna start with the idea that we have, I'm gonna call it lambda. What have you been using for all the weights and biases? Like the parameter?
W and B.
Okay, so lambda will be all W's and B's. It'll be all the parameters of a neural network. X will be the data, you know, that's sampled. You know, if you have a distribution, if this was a Boltzmann distribution, then X would be all the Ising spins, up, down, up, down, up, down, whatever, right? And so what a probability graphical model is basically a diagrammatic representation of a probability distribution, where the distribution is encoded in the network parameters, if you will. So parameterized by, say, lambda equals weights. I'm going to define everything. I'm just kind of giving the outline. Weights, biases, etc. Okay. Once you have a probabilistic graphical model that's been trained on data, you can use it to generate new data, if you will. So that's the philosophy of generative modeling. And there's many different types of graphical models. There's some that have directed graphs, like if you guys had feed-forward neural networks, right, those have a direction. Forward is different than backwards. If you're talking about encoding probabilities, if you have directed graphs, you usually encode Bayesian probabilities. If you have undirected models, which is what we're going to consider, then these are called Markov random field models. You probably don't have to know all this, but you know, you can imagine a graphical model being something like nodes that, you know, have a direction, or, you know, nodes that don't have a direction, and, you know, directional graphs, like I said. Are Bayesian. And undirected, which we will consider, are called Markov random field models. And you'll see why when we talk about basically the Gibbs sampling. Okay, so who's studied Bayesian statistics before? So you're not allowed to say anything then. For the rest of you, I'm going to introduce the idea of Bayesian probabilities through a game show called, I guess it was Monty Hall, I don't know. So it's called the Monty Hall problem, okay? Don't Google it right now. Okay. In the Monty Hall problem, there's a game show host and a contestant. And the oh shit, that went behind the other board. Sorry. How do you do this? Can I keep it like that?
Yeah. Sound
good? So there's three doors. And behind one of these doors is a prize, like a new car. I think in the original formulation, there's one car and three goats, or two goats. It's stupid. So door number one, door number two, door number three. So let me see if I can get this right. Okay, so there's one prize, a car. I don't know why. I don't know why it's behind a door. And it's equally probable to be, you know, equal probability of being behind each door. Okay? So one third of chance that the car is here, you know, one third here, one third here. Okay. It's a game show, so you're a contestant. You get to choose one door. And I'm the host. I know which door the car is behind, okay? So you choose a door, and the host who knows me reveals one of the non-selected doors. Okay, Alex, I'll write this down, okay? Which does not contain the car. The question is, do you change your selection after that happens, okay? So that's the Monty Hall problem. So let me write that down. You, the contestant, say it's door number one. Just to keep things straight, say door number one, okay? And then me, the host, reveals a non-selected door, so either two or three, okay? And the door that I choose, because I know where the car is, does not contain the car. Okay, so let's say, just for this example, that I choose door number two. So now, there's three doors. There's this one, your choice, number one, which you made. There's an open door two, number two, no car. And there's a closed door, number three, which you don't know anything about, okay? So you don't know anything about what is going on behind door number three. So the question is, to you, the contestant, do you stick with your original choice, which is door one, or do you switch your choice to door three? Number one, or switch. Number three. Should I bother polling you guys? I don't really care what you think. But do you gain an advantage? Are you more likely, you know, to win the car if you switch your choices? What do you think? Is it obvious either way? That's a problem in Bayesian statistics. So if you know Bayes' theorem, you can solve this mathematically. Or you can do an experiment with a whole bunch of doors. So let's look how to solve it with Bayesian statistics. I mean, I think naively, you would say that, well, the car has equal probability of being behind each door. So why does that change? Right? It should be a third, right? But now you know something. You know something about the state of the system. So I've opened a door that doesn't have a car, right? And, you know, I have some knowledge about where that car is. So it's either behind one or three, right? So does my knowledge change your chances of winning that car based on this action? So let's see how we would solve this with Bayesian probabilities. And we're going to use these Bayesian probabilities in training basically the restrictive Boltzmann machines, which are probabilistic graphical models. Okay. So there's a point to this.
Okay, so
how am I spelling Bayesian? I'm sure it's wrong. So the fundamental, I think, object in a Bayesian probability is a conditional probability. Okay? So the probability of something given something else. So let's introduce some notation. I'll call it P. Let's do A vertical bar B. Okay, so that's the probability of A given B. That's how I would say it. So that's related to other probabilities that you're probably more familiar with. Probability of just an occurrence of A, or a joint probability of two variables, which are A and B. And the Monte Hall problem, what we're trying to solve is, I'll define A and B, but it's the choice, the probability that, you know, the car is behind door one given the information about door two or something like that. Okay. So you've conditioned your, you know, probability of some event happening. P of A, so just by way of notation or definition, is, I would say, the trace of the total joint. Oh, I should have done the joint probability first. So because you guys know statistical physics and StatMech and traces and stuff, you're used to this notation. This is just a trace over all the possible occurrences of B, whatever that is. In the statistical literature, they call this a marginal or marginalized probability. I think it's marginal. So all states of B are traced out. This joint probability, there's nothing much to say about it, besides it's the probability of both variables, you know. You deal with this all the time, right? When you have multiple variables in a statistical system or a StatMech system. Here we're only talking about two. But if you had to imagine a whole bunch of Ising spins, you took a partial trace, you'd have a big joint probability distribution, and that partial trace would be marginalizing out part of the system, for example. Okay, and so I think the main, the main kind of connection between concepts you know and this conditional probability is the product rule, it's called. So the joint probability distribution is the conditional, you know, multiplied by P of A. And you know, vice versa for P. All right, so you can write in terms of of the conditional this way or conditional of A given B. So this is the product. So I say it's a, I'm going to say, it's probably wrong, but it's probably basically a postulate of Bayesian mechanics or Bayesian statistics. So from this, and given the symmetry property, you can write down Bayes' rule. So plus P, what is it, P? So it's the joint, the symmetry of the joint distribution. I mean, that's just relabeling things. You'll get P of B conditioned on A, right, is P of A conditioned on B. P of B normalized by what am I doing? P of A here. Okay. Oh. Let's see if I did that right. That's called Bayes' theorem. Bayes. Maybe like this. They have names for these things. Posterior equals likelihood times prior is one way to think about it. Normalized appropriately. So if you hear words like posterior and prior, it's related to this theorem. And the power of it is that you're trying to calculate something like B, B might be the, what am I going to use for this problem? I got to think about it, but B is the event that I show you an empty door conditioned on the fact that you have chosen one or something. That's what you're trying to calculate. And typically, you know the other conditional one. So typically, you can calculate one of the conditionals, but you want to learn the inverse. So that's what Bayes' theorem is good for. Okay, let's just try it. Let's go back to this Monte Hall problem. So I just need to frame what A and B are, and then I can solve this choice. So back. Okay, so I've assumed that you've picked one, and I reveal two, okay? That's door number one. And I reveal door number two. Okay, so let me do this. So A will be the event that the car is behind door one. Okay, I've picked it. I want to know if the car is behind there. B is the event that I show you an empty door to. So this is the only hard part, is picking what these events are. Why? Okay, so what I can calculate is the, I wrote it backwards, okay. So what I want is P of A conditioned on the event that I've opened door number two. That's what I want, right? Is it 1/3? And from Bayes' theorem, okay, so this is, P of A, given B. I don't know, did I get this backwards? That's A, B on B of A, right? P of A normalized by P of B. Okay, so what is P condition, what B conditioned on A? So B is the event that I show an empty door in, you know, number two, conditioned on the event that the car is behind door one. What is that? It's a half, right? So if I pick the right door here, back here, I picked one. Sorry, you've picked one. And I'm the host, and I know the car's behind there. I have two equally good choices of doors to open. Right? So that's P, B conditioned on A. It's one half. P A is just the overall probability that a car is behind door one. I already said that that's equal. You know, it's equal for every, so it's one half times a one third. It's equal for every door. I just got to figure out what P of B is. B is the event that I show an empty door number two. But I can solve this by using, what do I need? The product rule. So P of B. So I need to sum over B, P of AB, and then use the product rule. So maybe this is too much detail. P of B given A, P of A. It's just a normalization, right? I have a specific instance up top here. Now I normalize it. This is always a third for every door, but now I have the sum over all the possible doors, right? So what is that P given it? B condition on A, right? So you just got to think about, there's only three different cases. If the car is behind door number one, this is the, you know, this is the one I talked about here, then the door is open 50% of the time, right? And which door? It's door two, right? Because that's the event B. If the car is number one, door number two, open 50% of the time. If the car is behind door number two, right? So we're including all elements in this sum here, in this normalization. Then are you going to ever open door two as a host? Or am I ever going to open door two? Never, right? So if the car is and if it's behind door three, then door two is opened 100% of the time. You've picked one. Sorry. This is P of, so the car is behind door three, and you've picked door one, right? I'm picking another door that doesn't have the car, so it's 100% of the chance I open door two. Okay, so that's it. Problem solved. So you got to add those up. They're on your denominator. Right, so that's P of B, one third times one half plus one third times zero plus one third times one, one half. So P of A, condition on B, one half times one third over one half is one third. So what does that mean? Do you change your choice or not?
No.
You what?
Change your choice.
Why?
Because the other one, P of the car being in door number 3 is now 2/3.
Right. Because door 2 is already open, right? So, okay. So that conditional, which has occurred, you know, the event that I show you an empty door under number 2, has made it so that A is a third, and because probabilities equal, sum up to 1, I don't know. So there is a 1 minus 1/3 equals 2/3 chance. Behind door number 3. So yes to the question, change the door that you've picked. So we're going to use these conditional probabilities. We're going to use them all the time. You're going to sample generative graphical models using conditional probabilities. You're basically going to use these definitions when you build these generative models using these restricted Bolson machines. Questions on that? Does that make sense? It's got to be right, eh? Okay, so let's build up just kind of conceptually the idea behind what we're doing. Okay. So that was just background. That's a tool we need. So I'm going to say the goal of generative modeling for us is to produce a good estimate for P lambda, which is I'm going to represent graphically now. So let's think about how we do that. And by good, I'm going to mean that it's approximately equal to some Q of X, which is the physical distribution that underlies the data set. I'm going to call it physical because you guys are looking at physical models. It's a set of all X vectors. It's probably limited, maybe of 100,000. How many pictures of cats are there on the internet? Probably not that many, right? So that set could be your training set for this probabilistic graphical model. Once we have the model distribution tuned as close as we can to the underlying distribution that comes from that cats come from, then we want to generate new pictures of cats. So then we want to generate new instances of, say, X vectors, possibly not contained in the original data set. So how do we construct a probabilistic graphical model? You know, what is P of lambda? So we're just going to do that today and get into the details of training tomorrow morning. Okay. So this is really just a conceptual kind of introduction. So what data sets have you guys looked at? Ising model, 2D Ising, and the gauge theory. Did you do that one? Z2 gauge theory? Huh? What else? Is that it?
And this?
Do you guys not remember? So we'll imagine, you know, imagine that your, did you write a Monte Carlo program or the Ising model? Okay, so you have a data set. So you have a data set, you don't know where it comes from. But imagine it's sampled somehow from a Boltzmann distribution and, you know, keep that in mind. So I think when you do your tutorial, hopefully on this, that'll make sense. So that Q of X is like a Boltzmann distribution, say, of Ising spins. Or it could be a Boltzmann distribution of anything physical, okay? How do I take that data set, like, which is basically coming from a black box, because you guys don't know where it came from, apparently, and how do I try to figure out what that underlying physical distribution is? Okay, that's the problem. So one solution is to encode the probability distribution in something called a hop field network. We're not going to do this, but I think it's, I think it's informative. So a hop field network is like an Ising Hamiltonian, okay? But it's connected in a strange way. It's basically all to all connected. Each one of these circles, I don't know, nodes, is a variable, you know, xi, which can be, say, 0 or 1. So just binary variables. And every single one of these is connected. It's fully connected. I'm not going to get them all. Whatever. Good enough. So it's an Ising model, but it's not a physical Ising model with a two-dimensional lattice or a hypercube or a one whatever. You know, it's all to all connected. Okay, so it's an undirected graphical model of a probability distribution, which I'll define, because you define an energy for this lattice, basically. Okay, so you know, these are like, I'll say, like an Ising model, or they are an Ising model. And they have an energy. With energy, E given a state of the variables, all of the x of I, right? 1/2, okay, some I. There's n of these things, maybe small n, j equals 1 to n. I can use the notation like a weight matrix, because now you guys are well versed in neural networks. Okay, weights and biases, but really they're just JIJs or whatever you want to call them. They're exchange and magnetic field. Okay, just an Ising model. Crazy. Why would you do this? Here's all your W. IJs, here's XJ. So hop field network is one of the simplest undirected sort of graphical models. There's no directions on this thing. You know, in any other building, you would, you know, try to motivate this. But here we don't have to. It's just an Ising model. Okay. We can assign a Boltzmann distribution to it. To this thing. I could call this E of lambda, where, you know, lambdas are all the weights, you know, the set of weights and biases. Weights and biases. Weights is a matrix. Biases, H as I called them. No, let's use B's. I need H for something else. And I can define a Boltzmann distribution in the usual way. And P lambda, you know, okay, equals 1 over Z lambda e to the minus E, say lambda. So that's just how you take a graph and you encode a probability distribution. That's all it is. And if you had a data set that was drawn from a probability distribution in that black box that somebody gave you, and you don't know what's going on there. You can imagine tuning the weights and biases of this energy function so that this probability distribution looked as close as possible to the distribution that underlies the data set. So that's the idea of machine learning with these types of networks. So learning, you know, machine learning. So that P lambda is approximately equal to Q. You don't know explicitly Q, you know, you don't have the analytical form for it. So you need to somehow, you know, take that data set, you know, you might have, you know, you got to take S, which is a set of X1 vector, X2 vector, I don't know, maybe there's 10,000 cat pictures, and take that set and somehow define a procedure so that you can adjust all the weights and biases. And say that initial data set, S, was drawn from a two-dimensional Ising model, like you guys have a data set for that. So you know, that's that, the Q is the Boltzmann distribution, maybe it's at some temperature. Then you would hope that you would learn sort of all the two-dimensional, you know, couplings here. You would hope that you would learn weights that are strong if these are nearest neighbor, and weak if they're not nearest neighbor, or zero, potentially, right? And you hope you would basically learn the right prefactor in front of the, you know, the right scale factor to give you a temperature and so on. And the bottom line is that doesn't work. And that's why nobody talks about Hopfield networks. Class over. No, just kidding. They're historically important. They were models of memory in the 80s. And what people found was, okay, so there's some motivation for talking about models of memory with Hopfield networks, but basically people found that this concept of training them doesn't work. You can't take this data set S and you can't push it in there and train those weights and biases. So it's a big failure, but it's conceptually nice because it's like you can imagine learning an Ising model, right? That's especially relevant if your underlying data set is pulled from an Ising model, but it doesn't have to be. So these types of graphical representations have some universality theorem that say they can represent any probability distribution given certain conditions. I don't know what they are. I forget. Let's look at another network. Boltzmann machine. A Boltzmann machine, it's like a Hopfield network. But it's a Hopfield network that's been extended to be more powerful. Extended in a kind of non-trivial way that you'll recognize. So the original Hopfield network had as many nodes as there were elements of the vector X, right? So if you had so imagine that your black box contained a 2D Ising model with 64 spins, right? An 8x8 lattice. There's 64 of these nodes. And there's many more weights, but you know, that's the learning problem. You don't know the underlying structure of Q or of the Hamiltonian that gives you Q. So a Boltzmann machine would take the same number of, now I'm going to call them visible units, whatever. Am I missing one? I don't know. And also add hidden units. So these are visible. There's as many of them as there are elements in X, each vector X. I don't know how to write that. But then you also have hidden units. So I'll draw them over here. Maybe only of three. I don't know. Each one of these hidden units is connected to all visible units. Oops. And maybe to each other. I don't know. You could have connections here if you want. What did I call these? Visible and hidden. Can you see this dark chalk? So it's an extended hop field network or a generalization. That has, I don't know, some hidden nodes. So in terms of representational power, you know, in terms of being able to encode any probability distribution, this should be considered more powerful than Hopfield network. of just visible, you know. Your data set always has some fixed size, right? These vectors, you know, there's 64, say, Ising spins in each vector, 64 pixels in your cat image, whatever it is. So these are more powerful in principle. They represent a probability distribution. This you can imagine training these things. Or, you know, learning the parameters, all the weights and biases, so that, remember, we want P of lambda on X to be as close as possible to Q of X. But in this case, I have more units than just than X, right? Each one of these is X. But I have more units here. And so I don't want necessarily the probability distribution that I'm comparing to my physical distribution to include these ones, right? So let me call them something else. Let me call these, yeah, call them X's or V's. I'm going to start using V's for visible. And I'll use H or hiddens for these ones. Okay, so that's H vector 1, H vector 2, H vector 3. So the concept going forward will be that we want the marginalized distribution. So P of X lambda, right, which is the trace of all hiddens. P of X H to be as close as possible to Q. Okay. You know, that's fine and dandy and everything, but these things suffer from the same sort of problems of intractability and training as the original Hopfield network. So I've made something that is representationally more powerful. You know, there's more parameters, right? You have a fixed number of parameters here. You can't really have any more connections. Here I've just made more weights and biases. So it's more powerful, but it's not any better in terms of training. Nobody uses these things. Class over. No, I'm just kidding. I got one more to show you. So the one that we're going to use is the restricted Bolson machine. So the restricted Bolson machine is like the Bolson machine. It's got a visible and hidden or latent space. But it has a special condition on both of these spaces. Okay, so. RBMs. Introduced in the 80s. I think they were called something else when they were introduced. So I'm not going to write that. Smolensky. He called them harmonium or harmony or something. RBMs were, I think, in the early 2000s, basically popularized by Hinton's group because he showed how to train them. So let's take my, I'm going to start calling my X's V's for visible. V. Visible and H I for hidden. And define, so let's do it in full. Let's find the joint distribution. I alluded to it right there. The joint distribution, V H. It's 1 over the partition function, just a normalization. E lambda VH. And I'm going to write E like this. So sum over all IJ, WIJ. But here's the trick. You only want to connect visibles and hiddens. IJ. That's where they're restricted, okay? And then I want to biases, so I think, so I'm going to call them I, bias I on visibles, and you're going to have different names for the biases on the hiddens. Is that a dumb idea? No, let's do it. C, HJ. So the picture is, I'm going to draw the visibles like this now. These are all the visibles. These are the hiddens. H. And the weights connect only between layers. It's fully connected. Looks like a mess. That's enough. Each one of these is a WIJ. And then you also have biases, which are like local fields, you know, attached. What did I call this one? C. And this is B. BI. Whatever. That's a restricted Boltzmann machine. This thing, which we'll prove over the next 2 days, has an efficient training algorithm. And it's because of those restrictions between all the visibles and all the hiddens, okay? So it gets, you know, it's the same concept as hot field networks. You take a data set, you feed it into the neural network. It's got this power of adjustable numbers of parameters. So you saw this with feed-forward neural networks, maybe. You adjust the, that's why I kind of drew it like that. You can adjust the numbers of parameters in the network by changing the number of hidden units. All you do in the end is trace them out anyway, right? So it gives you this kind of variable representational power that you can use as a convergence parameter. But it's trainable, has an efficient training algorithm. Okay? What else you need to know? Maybe Zeds? VI, HI, J, whatever. You're just tracing out the energies. Lambdas for completeness, just weights. Biases. What are these used for? We're gonna talk about their use in physics. So what I'm gonna do tomorrow is discuss training these things, and you're going to train them on an Ising model data set. And then once they're trained, we're going to use them for generative modeling. Just what I said here. You know, you're going to generate new instances of configurations. Okay. And if the thing is trained properly, you'll produce new instances of configurations that are distributed according to the unknown but underlying Q of X, which underlies the data set. So we're doing the same, condition for learning there. We're taking the marginalized distribution and we're comparing it to the underlying physical distribution. So the task we have is to turn that thing into a cost function or into a sort of gradient descent algorithm. Okay? So you have to say, I have two probability distributions. One is encoded in the graphical model. One is underlying the data set, so I don't actually know an explicit form for them. And I have to take these two distributions and I have to make them as close as possible by adjusting the weights and biases in some gradient descent procedure. It sounds complicated. It is complicated. It took these guys years. We're not going to do that now. I just want to make a couple notes. We just borrowed these from industry. Who's these guys, right? Smolinski, Hinton students. These are big in the, you know, since people study these since the 80s into the 2000s. And I would say pre-2012, they were pretty important. For, I would say, unsupervised pre-training. They're unsupervised, right? There's no labels. You're taking a data set, you're jamming it in that Boltzmann machine, you're getting a probability distribution, there's no labels, there's nothing. It's just a probability distribution. Pre-2012, people had, you know, classifiers and discriminators and so on, and they had trouble training them on raw data. So what people did was train Boltzmann machines, okay, and they would take the out, once they're trained, they would generate new samples. And you and I are going to be interested in new samples in the visible layer to calculate physics things. But people were interested also in the samples produced by the hidden layer, the latent space, you know. So people took those latent variables that were generated and fed those into discriminators, like feed-forward neural networks. And that produced more efficient training for deep learning, basically. I'll say for deep learning. So they basically just provided, H vectors, okay. So that H vector is fed into a linear classifier, whatever. An SVM, I don't know. I don't even know what they did. Feed-forward neural network, like I was saying, for deep learning. You could try that if you wanted to. The idea was there was some higher abstraction of the raw data. You know, you put it into some abstracted space in your latent space. Make that latent space as small as possible. And then that higher abstraction was closer to the kind of minimum of the optimization landscape that you're seeking. After you pre-trained, have this generative model, you put it, say, through a feed-forward neural network, and then you could actually update the parameters and all the layers. In 2012, I think basically convolution, like CNNs, blew this out of the water. So people quit using RBMs for this purpose. There was also, uses in collaborative filtering, it's called. So, oh man, Salhutinov, Min, and Hinton have a good paper from 2007. Collaborative filtering's, I think, best embodied in the Netflix recommendation system. So I've seen some movies, I've ranked them. How do I get my algorithm to determine how I might rank a movie I haven't seen, right? That's a recommender system, recommendation system. Because I want that algorithm to recommend movies that will also get high ratings from me, or else that recommendation sucks and I hate Netflix because of it, right? So that's called the Netflix. I think there's a competition. So you're given a user rating, given a user's ranking, predict the ranking of an unseen movie. It's cool, check it out. Because there's one Bolson machine for every person, basically. My Netflix account has a certain amount of movies I've seen. And so what happens is you have a visible unit. And a visible unit was the rankings, which actually were softmax in this case. You know, there might be five rankings. So you might have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 for one movie. I don't know, Titanic. You know, I really loved Cars. You know, I really hated whatever. Shape of Water, you see that? It sucked. So, and then there's a movie I haven't seen, you know, and then there's some other movie that was really kind of mediocre, whatever. So there's a visible unit that I don't have a softmax function for, and I want the network to predict that, so I have hidden units, okay? And the thing with collaborative filtering is I have another user that's seen this movie, and I use his or her weights that connect to the same hidden units, okay? So I actually have many Bolson machines, one for each person, and the more movies you see, the better trained your machine. Then I share the weights that I've trained between other users. And so this type of collaborative filtering allows, you know, me to generate another visible unit here, you know, for whatever, Star Trek, and that, you know, that's the basis of the recommendation system. That's cool, right? I think we should be able to use this for physics somehow, but I haven't figured out how. I mean, it's like when you have missing data, right? So you have a bunch of data, you're feeding in for different use cases, and the idea of sharing weights between machines. I mean, this is one of the older uses of RBMs.
What happened in 2012?
What
happened in 2012?
That's when basically this ImageNet classification was blown away by I forget the name. I forget the name of the paper. It's Hinton and his two students. We were immediately both bought by Google. So it's called ImageNet classification with deep convolutional neural networks, I think is the paper. So, you know, they have these conferences, and they have like ImageNet was the Olympics of image recognition, and there was benchmarks, and the images are like a koala eating something, or like, you know, somebody with a seatbelt over his face. Like, they're really weird. And they're like historically were hard to classify. And so, you know, there was some probabilities of you know, this one's definitely a koala with 100% or, you know, with 80% accuracy, but it's maybe a wombat. And Hinton went in with this like deep convolutional networks and basically like took all these percentage points and blew them up to like 90 something percent. So it was just like, it blew everyone away. That paper has 15,000 citations now. So what the convolution networks did is make it so that you didn't have to patch together all this pre-training and stuff. You just feed them in and the convolutions do a lot of the, I mean, it makes sense for us because the convolutions bring back locality, dimensionality, and so on into your data set, right? Whereas before, fully feed forward neural networks just completely you know, it's like these things. There's no locality, there's no dimension. Locality is like the most important concept in physics almost, right? So we're used to dealing with it, but these guys, you know, they had images that have some local regions. And the question was, how do you capture that? And so convolutional filters kind of changed everything there. Question?
Just with this, so are you training initially without your like unseen movie?
So if there's unseen movies, you don't train those weights. Yeah. So you only train the weights for the movies you've seen, and you share those weights around different users. That's how I understand it. I've never done it. And there's softmax or maybe one hots because like it sucks excellent, and you really only, you know, so it's a little different. We're going to deal with binary units always, zeros or ones, but these recommender systems often use softmax for the input. I don't know what else. They used RBMs for like, what's it called when you interpret text, like feed a book through it and feed Harry Potter through it and like what was the wizard's name? So they used to use RBMs for that, but I think, I'm not sure that's still the case. So we're going to talk about training. And then we're going to talk about sampling the visible units, basically starting tomorrow. So there'll be more math. What am I missing?
Oh, why do you use the hidden units occasionally to train?
So here, when I do it like this, you need the hidden units because there's no.
Sorry, I meant like.
Why would you do it here?
No, like when you're like feeding them back in occasionally, like what is. What do they represent usually?
Like here in this case, or you mean here when I do the pre-training?
Yeah, like you say sometimes like you use the latent space.
Yeah, so nobody, I mean, it's a question of interpretation, right? If I knew exactly what to feed into the neural network, I wouldn't need a neural network. So you're hoping that like successive layers of abstraction, if built correctly, kind of take your raw data and make more, emphasize features. That's what I should say. So the hope is that the hidden or the latent space has emphasized certain features. And then when you feed those features in to a discriminator, it's just easier. It's just like you have a big optimization landscape and you've started at a different point. You know, instead of starting way high in the high energy or high free energy region, you've started halfway down already in the right, you know, the right part of the landscape. I don't know, I think of everything in terms of free energy landscapes. So I don't know. I think nobody really knows why they work.
So what's the difference between, you know, training your RBM and then feeding that pre-trained data and having, you know, maybe several hidden layers in your just basic neural network?
I think it's just a question of training.
I mean, the few layers of your neural network would
be that anyway. RBMs, yeah. Right? No, so I literally think it's just how easy or how fast it is to do that training. So like, it's very empirical. It's very like, you know, these were used for a while because people demonstrated that pre-training in an unsupervised manner made the rest of the training easier. You would still go all the way through all the layers, but some of them were already pre-trained somehow, right? So, yeah. That's what I like about machine learning is it's heuristically built algorithms that work. You know? And now we're trying to kind of interpret them and understand whether or not there's, you know, I guess, scaling improvements for some of our problems. You're dismissed. Is that how we end these classes?